Nine of them are in the opposition. The opposition is divided, and they always have been. And there's a spectrum. I wouldn't call any of those nine opposition candidates part of the left, but I would certainly call Edmundo González and María Corina Machado part of the far right, and their history shows that. In terms of the left in Venezuela, there is a so-called faction called what they call themselves dissident Chavistas, which is mostly made up of academics and former government ministers, but they don't have an electoral base. They have no power on the streets, and they really have little to no influence within Venezuela itself.
And let's put that question to Alejandro Velasco as well. Divisions in the left, those who support Maduro and those who don't.
I mean, on the one hand, the landscape that we just heard is certainly accurate. I think it's incomplete, though. What we've seen, whether we put the focus on sanctions, whether we put the focus on policies on the part of the Maduro government to specifically target popular sectors by way of, you know, security operations, et cetera. I think it is hard to claim that on the ground there isn't significant amount of critique against the Maduro government from sectors that previously supported even Maduro, but certainly before Chavez. Some of these have left Venezuela in, you know, massive amounts of numbers over the last 10 years. I think the Chavismo internally and supporters abroad do themselves a disservice by not recognizing massive amounts of discontent. We can talk and debate about the reasons for that discontent. Absolutely, the sanctions are part of that landscape. But to, you know, not move the needle and recognize that there is significant discontent on the ground at popular levels against the Maduro government is a recipe for basically placing all of what we understand to be the project of the Bolivarian Revolution that Hugo Chavez started and conflating it with Maduro staying in power. That is a tremendous risk that the left internationally runs if the left is going to try to have a continuing viable political project in Venezuela that's decoupled or delinked from Maduro in power.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to Leonardo Flores on this issue of the comparison you made to Trump and the 2020 Stop the Steal movement, allegedly. There's no doubt that the United States has systematically attempted for the last 25 years to remove the Bolivarian Revolution from power in Venezuela. But at the same time, it's not quite the same thing, because even the comparison to the 2020 election, because at least Trump was arguing against actual election results, state by state, city by city, and in his attempts to overturn that election, those election results. But here, there have been no published results of the election, precinct by precinct. So it's not quite the same thing, is it?
It's not quite the same, but it is very similar. I mean, it's not just Trump, of course. It's also Bolsonaro. There are ties between Edmundo González, María Corina Machado, and the far right throughout the hemisphere. And yeah, you're right. We haven't seen the precinct by precinct results yet. The CNE has issued two bulletins showing the generalized results. By law, though, they have 30 days to present those results. We're not anywhere close to those 30 days being up, or about 2 weeks away. And already the CNE has turned over all of its data, including evidence of a massive cyber attack that occurred in Venezuela on July 28th, Election Day, and has continued since then, a cyber attack which we have evidence for from firms even in the United States, which have recognized a tenfold increase in denial of service attacks against Venezuelan websites, including the PSUV party.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank our two Venezuelan guests, Leonardo Flores, political analyst, activist, founding member of Venezuela Solidarity Network, and NYU Associate Professor Alejandro Velasco. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
I'm gone away. One for every time I should have stayed. You should have wore my wedding ring. I've got 16 days, 15 of those are nights. Can't sleep when the bed she fights. Sway back to your side. We'll close the sky and run. Sleep when the bedsheet fights. Sway back to your side. We'll go to Scotland. We'll go to Scotland.
Family doesn't live here anymore. tango, pre-recorded earlier in the moonlight at an angle. These are the kind of scrapes that we're getting to. Standing over by the bar looking at me, I'm looking at you. The house doesn't stand here. Feminine live here anymore. Close down the liquor store for Christmas. Standing over in the alleyway, waiting for the rich ones. These are the kind of games that we play in hell. Look at the little Santa Claus ringing.
street is dark and bold and out mysteriously. Where lies the chance we take to be always working, reaching out for a hand that we can't see? Everybody's got a hold on hope. It's the last thing that's holding me. Invitation to the last dance. Then it's time to leave. That's the price we pay when we deceive.
Say I need you, babe, but I'm gonna get you, babe, and I will not do you wrong. Living's mostly wasting time. I'll waste my share of mine, but it never feels too good, so let's don't take too long. For you're soft as glass, and I'm a gentle man. Got the sky to talk about and the world to lie on. Well, days up and down they come, like rain on a kunga drum. Forget most, remember some, all but don't turn none away. Everything is not enough. Nothing is too much to bear. Where you've been is good and gone. All you keep is the getting there. But to live's to fly, all low and high. So shake the dust off of your wings and the sleep out of your eyes. goodbye to all my friends. It's time to go again. Think all the poetry and the picking down the line. I miss the system here. The bottom's low and the treble's clear. But it don't pay to think too much on things you leave behind. Well, I may be gone, but it won't be long. I'll be bringing back the melody and the rhythm that I find. We all got holes to fill. Them holes are all that's real. Some fall on you like a storm. Sometimes you dig your own. The choice is yours to make. Time is yours to take. Some dive into the sea. Some toil upon the stone. But to live's to fly. Low high. So shake the dust off of your wings and the sleep out of your eyes. Or shake the dust off of your wings and the tears out of your eyes.
The stars are shining brighter than the night that I remember. My thoughts are like a river, reflecting in all directions. I'm gonna phone her, but not today. I'm gonna write her, but not today. But not today. Today, yeah. I'm over you. 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 I'm over you.
It takes 6 seconds or the length of 2 football fields for a large truck traveling at a safe speed to come to a complete stop. Never cut in front of an 18-wheeler for any reason. Our roads, our responsibility.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you don't hear the phrase free market capitalism so much anymore, but the idea still tacitly undergirds much of what you do hear about why products and services are the way they are. We all know about corruption and cronyism, but we still accept that the company that wins, that corners the market, does so because people simply prefer what they sell. The anti-monopoly ruling against Google challenges that idea of how things work. We'll hear about it from Lee Heppner, senior legal counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project. Also on the show, a recent news report offered the familiar construction that the attacks of September 11th, 2001 plunged the U.S. into decades of war. Of course, that's not right. Choices were made, unpopular choices, about how to respond to the attacks. Choices were made to not bring assailants to trial for the crime, but instead to detain people without charge and hold them indefinitely in a prison designed to be outside U.S. law. None of it was inevitable. Now the defense secretary has stepped in to overturn plea agreements that, while they wouldn't have closed Guantanamo, would have brought some measure of closure to the cases against the alleged directors of the September 11th attacks. We'll get an update from Shaina Kadudal, senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. We With the presidential contest in full swing, the Sinclair Broadcast Group appears to be ramping up its right-wing propaganda again. While millions of Americans are subjected to the TV network's electioneering, few know it. That's because, as Pete Tucker details for Fair.org, Sinclair blends into the woodwork. So when you turn on your local news, you may well be watching a Sinclair station, even though on your screen it appears labeled as a major network, like CBS, NBC, or Fox. Millions of people tell pollsters they no longer trust the news media, but there's an exception. At least 6 years ago or so, 76% of Americans said they still trust their local news stations, more than the percentage professing to trust their family or friends, according to The New Yorker. Sinclair is smart enough to leave its affiliates alone long enough for them to develop a rapport with their audience. As former New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan put it, the fact that it looks normal most of the time is part of the problem. What Sinclair is cynically doing is trading on the trust that develops among local news people and their local audience. By hijacking this relationship, Sinclair can sneak its propaganda into millions of homes, including in presidential swing states where the network owns more stations than any other. How do they do it? By requiring affiliates to air the right-wing stories it sends them. But because these segments are introduced or delivered by trusted local hosts, they gain credibility. Usually it goes undetected, but in 2018, Sinclair pushed its luck by requiring anchors around the country to read from the identical Trumpian anti-media script, a video compilation of dozens, if not hundreds, of Sinclair anchors voicing the same commentary went viral. Nevertheless, Tucker explains, Sinclair carries on largely under the radar, quietly gobbling up stations, mainly in cheaper markets. We're forever expanding, like the universe, said longtime leader David Smith, under whose watch the network has become the second largest in the country. Of the 294 TV stations that Sinclair owns or operates, at least 70 of them air the network's in-house national evening news broadcast. In January, Eugene Ramirez, who had anchored that broadcast for a year and a half, resigned. His public explanation was that every night he was given a list of four stories produced out of Sinclair's headquarters. From these, he had to select at least three to air. Often these stories were little more than write-ups of press releases from right-wing politicians and groups, like one from July whose headline read, "Trump PAC launches new ad hitting Democrats on border. Joe Biden does nothing." Sinclair frequently booked far-right guests to appear on Ramirez's broadcast, and he was instructed not to interrupt them, according to reporting by Popular Information. Ramirez was told that many Sinclair affiliates were not in big cities, and the content of the broadcast had to reflect the sensitivities of those viewers. Needless to say, progressive guests rarely, if ever, appeared. Popular Information also found that Sinclair requires around 200 of its affiliates to air its question of the day, which has included such gems as, "Do you think former House Speaker Pelosi deserves some of the blame for the January 6th riot?" Other questions were less obviously biased, but still betrayed tenets of independent journalism. As Tucker writes, it's one thing when a blowhard on Fox News asks, "Are you concerned violent criminals are crossing the border?" But it's quite another when the same question is asked by a familiar and trusted local anchor. And then remember that it's not just one local anchor, but a small army of them in communities across the country every day. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Google is a monopolist, and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly. So ruled District Court Judge Ahmed Mehta in United States versus Google, being called a landmark antitrust case that will affect not just Google, but potentially all tech giants in the current landscape. The point was Google pays billions every year to companies like Apple and Samsung that distribute search engines to ensure that it's the only search engine anyone would see, by making sure it's the preset default on devices. If your supermarket only had one brand of milk on the shelf, even if it had some others in the back, you would recognize that as unfair. But for many of us, the internet is still a mystery miracle, and we're not used to bringing the same sorts of questions to bear. If it did nothing else, this ruling changes that. So what happened? Lee Heppner is an antitrust lawyer and senior legal counsel for the American Economic Liberties Project. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Lee Heppner.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Sherman Antitrust Act sounds like a history lesson. It's from 1890, but it's living, meaningful law. How or why exactly did the judge determine that Google was in violation of it?
You said it right there. This is a law that dates back to the 19th century. It used to be used against railroad barons, has now been applied to this new tech industry. It's really proof of the durability of one of the foundational laws for ensuring fair markets and competition across our economy. And Google is ripe for being addressed by this law. The judge found that Google was essentially without competition in the market for search engines. And truth be told, I mean, 80% of overall searches are conducted via Google on mobile devices. That's 95%. And Google is able to profit extraordinarily off of not having competition and by blocking out rivals who threaten to create new and innovative products that actually benefit consumers and move this technology forward. So that was really at the crux of the judge's decision in this case.
So it isn't just that Google is the default search engine. It's that they are doing things, including paying money, to maintain that and to prevent other companies from being that.
That's exactly right. And the judge really eloquently, in his opinion, describes how Google maintains its power through that circular system. It pays for exclusive agreements across Apple, Samsung, Mozilla, other device manufacturers. And by virtue of those exclusive agreements, it achieves scale that it then sells to advertisers for extraordinary revenue. And then it reinvests that revenue back at the beginning in securing those exclusive agreements. So you really see how this is a self-reinforcing monopoly that Google has been able to maintain through anti-competitive conduct.
Well, and we know it's not by accident, if anyone were to believe that. There are internal messages I just read in a piece by Matt Stoller where Google is saying inertia is the path of least resistance. They know what they're doing.
Oh, absolutely. It's a clear monopoly strategy. And just to be clear, those are the communications that we were able to see. Sure. Google was also criticized by this judge for deleting untold number of records that were relevant to the litigation. And that was a big part of this case, too, what Google didn't say, because they were training employees to move communications to secret servers that auto-deleted chats. So even in the absence of a smoking gun, there was a very clear sense that Google was intentionally perpetuating an illegal scheme to maintain its market power.
Well, it's worth noting that this isn't just kind of a meta issue or inconsequential. There is an impact of the quality of searches. You know, not everyone's just looking for Thai restaurant near me. It matters if searches are not the best that they could be, yeah?
Yeah, we've all heard stories about Google search becoming worse over time. It's kind of harder to find that thing that you were looking for because they're not necessarily investing in the rank of search results, or they're prioritizing paid ads that look like organic search results. So Google has maintained its monopoly position, not necessarily by having a superior product, but by blocking out rivals. And that's just a core characteristic of monopolies that is as old as time, and we see across a lot of industries.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say Google is not being punished for building a better mousetrap. And news media, I think, play a role here for the anthropomorphizing of especially tech companies as scrappy, as game changers. They're not AT&T. We've sort of been trained to think these guys, and they are guys, break the rules, but on behalf of all of us. And that's not what's happening here.
Well, sure. And it's just a radically different industry than it was, say, in the early 2000s after we broke up the last big monopoly, Microsoft. That was a quarter century ago since the last decision that on a case brought by the government against a big monopoly. And then we were seeing that kind of scrappy innovation. Google was a startup at that point. And I think right there really lends to the potential of this case and of this decision to unlock a new era of innovation where small tech innovators are able to have a chance at entering the market and creating something new and cool that maybe we can't imagine today, but wouldn't be possible without breaking up Google's hold on this industry.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think happens now? We can't necessarily predict it, but in terms of the case, what do you think will happen as we look to the remedy stage of things?
Just to be clear, this is a case that was bifurcated. We just concluded the liability phase, and now the judge has to decide what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And what's good about this stage is that the court has broad latitude and must be deferential to the government's request for remedies after that really difficult finding of liability. And there's a lot of tools on the table. Certainly, we can expect an end to some of the exclusive agreements that have tied up this market for Google. But we also might see structural remedies that deprive Google of some of its ill-gotten gains and divest certain business lines or allow other search engines to have access to properties like Google's web indexer or even their large language model. The future of search is really in artificial intelligence and the ability of chatbots to really revolutionize how people get information off the internet. And so I think that we're going to be really clued in to how this court crafts remedies that ensure that that next era of AI innovation is not being controlled by Google or any other dominant player in this market.
Well, and then finally, do you see knock-on effects? It does seem like a paradigm shift in terms of antitrust and the way we think about big companies. Do you see knock-on effects on not just tech companies, but other big businesses?
I do. And I think that when you have a case of this magnitude, there is going to be a bit of a culture shift. So if I'm a big law firm advising my clients, I'm going to tell them, hey, if you are entering into these types of exclusive agreements that are intended to maintain your market power, maybe you shouldn't do that anymore because the court is looking at these agreements with fresh eyes and they're not passing muster. I also think this decision builds momentum behind some of the other cases that the government has brought. There are parallels to the case against Live Nation, which also uses Ticketmaster to enter into exclusive agreements with venues. There are other parallels to the case against Apple or Amazon, which also kind of lock consumers into a single product ecosystem. So there's going to be knock-on effects outside of this case, outside of this industry, and also for other pending cases that we're watching closely.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Lee Heppner, Senior Legal Counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project. They're online at economicliberties.us. Thank you so much, Lee Heppner, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Years of negotiations led to the recently announced pretrial agreements for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other defendants accused of directing the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That would have meant their pleading guilty to charges including murder and conspiracy and receiving lifelong prison sentences. As AP put it, quote, "The torture that the defendants underwent while in CIA custody has slowed the cases and left the prospect of full trials and verdicts still uncertain, in part because of the inadmissibility of evidence linked to the torture. Close quote. But at the 11th hour, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin stepped in to override the agreements, claiming to do so in the name of victims' families, the U.S. military, and the American public, who, he says, deserve the opportunity to see a military commission trial play out. Here to help us understand what happened and what happens now is Shaina Katidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Counterspin, Shaina Katidal.
Thanks for having me.
Media attention to Guantanamo Bay and what happens to those held there has been spotty and in recent years largely absent. So listeners may have forgotten that men were held there for years without charge, much less conviction. Some have been approved for transfer, meaning they've been determined not to be a threat, yet have remained there. And of course, it's undisputed that many have been tortured and abused at this extra-legal military prison. So these plea agreements came with all of that context, all of that history. And they weren't seen as a victory for anyone. Those aren't the terms to think in. But they were seen as a meaningful and overdue step, yes?
Yeah, I think any plea bargain is a compromise, right? I've seen these described as kind of the least worst solution, given the history of these cases, right? And basically, they've been presented as trading off the death penalty in exchange for guilty pleas. But I think the thing listeners need to really know is that prosecutors, the military prosecutors, really badly wanted this deal done, because I think, like everyone else who is observing these cases, they recognize that the death penalty was never, as a practical matter, going to happen in these cases for a bunch of different reasons, right? First of all, the military commission system is incredibly slow. They've taken the most significant criminal trial of the century, the 9/11 case, and put it into a system where everything is being invented from scratch. So things that have been well established for two centuries in the federal criminal system have to be kind of reasoned out from the beginning in the military commissions. And then on top of that, there are these kind of issues around the use of torture evidence that have really slowed things down. That's not to say that torture evidence is the main problem standing in the way of a conviction. There is plenty of evidence against these particular defendants that isn't contaminated by torture, including interviews they did with media before they were ever captured. But the bottom line is that this process is going along really slowly. The defendants are in their mid-50s, the two older ones already. And then there are a bunch of other questions. Even if they got a guilty verdict, then there would be a sentencing phase where a military jury gets to decide between death and probably life imprisonment. And we know that the CIA is very reluctant to produce its own officials as witnesses in that kind of phase of proceedings. They basically refused to do it in another case that we had involving a plea bargain. So that may end up being something that stands in the way of a death penalty verdict. Then on top of that, there's a worry that military juries will do what some civilian juries have done and react to the torture at Guantanamo with clemency, that they'll want to punish the government by issuing a life sentence instead of death. So bottom line, the prosecutors really wanted this deal badly.
Well, that might surprise some folks, I think, on the face of it. And then kind of on the other hand, some people might imagine that any kind of plea deal would be opposed by the families and friends of those killed, the nearly 3,000 people killed on September 11th. But that wasn't really the case, was it?
Yeah, it's a very mixed bag, I must say, the family members. You know, there are a small group of family members who are very heavily engaged in the details of these cases, including the politics of it. And they fall all over the spectrum, just like regular Americans got 9/11 families with peaceful tomorrows who have been out there saying that they were strongly in favor of this deal because it offered some semblance of finality, and because part of the deal, apparently, there's the ability to pose questions, I believe in writing, to the defendants and have them answered within 45 days. And those questions would go to not just things like the motivations for carrying out the attacks, but also some detailed things that we don't have a lot of information about, even from their interrogations, things like the financing of the attacks, right? So the families wanted answers to these questions, and this was really the only way they were going to be able to get it. You know, on the other side, you've got folks who have been on Fox News a lot talking about how the commissions are much tougher than the civilian criminal system, which really, I think at this point in history, you can say is definitively not true. but have been kind of very actively organized in favor of keeping these cases in the military system. Right. I suppose it's probably worth noting that if these cases had been brought to the civilian system, they probably would have been over a long, long time ago. It's unfortunate that Eric Holder had made the decision in 2009 to bring these cases to New York and try them in front of a civilian jury. If that had been the case, as he said last week, these guys would have been a memory. The cases would have gone to trial in a year or two. The appeals would have been over in a year or two, and they probably would have received pretty severe sentences, maybe even death, and the cases would have been over. As Holder said, it was, quote-unquote, political hacks who stopped the cases from being brought to New York, where they would have been disposed of much more quickly than in the commissions. But again, that's sort of political water under the bridge. Congress has banned bringing men to the United States for trial from Guantanamo. So again, this is kind of the least worst solution, plea bargain in the military trial system.
Well, when people hear that Defense Secretary Austin revoked the pretrial agreements because there ought to be trials, I think a lot of people might be misled about what is meant by a trial in this situation, a military commission trial. What should we know about that?
Well, the first thing is that it's going to take years to get there. These charges originally were brought in February 2008, and so it's been, 15, 16 years of pretrial motions. And they're nowhere close to being done with that. Then once you get to a trial, there are going to be all sorts of issues about, again, the CIA producing witnesses to what they did to these men, not just in the merits phase, but also in the sentencing phase, and then also where it took place. Like, we have a lot of sensitive diplomatic kind of concerns around where the secret prisons the CIA held these men in were located, right? So that may stand in the way of actually conducting a trial. And after that, we've got appeals into a military appeal system, and then from there into the appellate courts in the federal system, and then to the Supreme Court. So, again, the oldest of these defendants is 56 years old. They are de facto already serving life sentences if you think that these cases are never going to come to a resolution after a trial and appeals. And so, again, it made perfect sense for the prosecutors to pursue this. The real question is kind of, what was Lloyd Austin thinking? He had to have been aware that these negotiations were underway and were pretty close to being resolved. The New York Times even reported over the weekend that DOD officials knew about the progress of the negotiations. So why the reversal? I mean, I think there's no explanation other than politics in the election.
That's what I was going to ask, because Austin says he's long believed that military trials were the only way forward. So that rings a little weird given the timing.
Well, when you see people like Tom Cotton coming out and saying that this is Biden being soft on the terrorists with the plea bargain deal, you can understand why it might have been everybody's preferred timing on the political end for this to happen after November. You know, but what comes next? Look, first, there'll be legal challenges. There are very narrow circumstances where a signed pretrial agreement like this, a plea bargain agreement, can be withdrawn. So I think the defendants are first probably going to challenge whether or not what Austin tried to do in voiding the agreements was even effective, whether he has power to void them. And on top of that, military prosecutors are supposed to be relatively independent from people above them in the chain of command. In the federal civilian criminal system, everybody knows that President Trump can remove the attorney general if he doesn't like some prosecution that he's undertaking, right? But there are some norms about how the AG is supposed to be relatively independent in making judgment calls, right? Well, on the military system, those aren't norms. They're actually written into the two major statutes, the Military Commissions Act and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So when you have a civilian official like Lloyd Austin, a political appointee, trying to pull the strings on a prosecutor's judgment, it's a serious problem. And dismissal of the case is the usual remedy for that. So again, something that could add years and years more delay to a system that wasn't exactly moving along quickly.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Shaina Kadidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can track their work on Guantanamo cases and others at ccrjustice.org. Shaina Kadidal, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you by the Media Watch Group Fair, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find years of shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The website is also the place to learn about Fair's newsletter Extra and to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Cost. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I told you once and I told you twice, but you never listen to my advice. You don't try very hard to please me. What you know, it should come easy. Well, this could be the last time. This could be the last time. Maybe the last time. I don't know. Oh, no. Oh, no. But I'm sorry, girl, but I can't stay. I'm feeling like I did today. Too much pain and too much sorrow. I guess I'll feel the same tomorrow. This could be the last time. This could be the last time. Maybe the last time. I don't know. Oh no. Oh no. And I told you twice, someone will have to pay.
chance to change your mind. 'Cause I've been wrong.